Hello, everybody, and once again, welcome to the Zelda Universe Podcast. My name is Connor Schultz, and it is a wonderful joy to be with you again as we explore our memories and treasure times in the lands of Hyrule and beyond. Joining me today, we have a new contributor both to the podcast and to Zelda Universe as a whole. Alex, if you would like to introduce yourself to everybody.
Hi, my name is Alexander Callahan. I've started writing recently features for Zelda Universe. I've been very excited to be a part of that. And yeah, it was a nice surprise to be welcomed to this podcast. So thank you, Connor, for having me.
Not only is he been welcome to the podcast, he's the only other one here.
It's just the two of us.
Just the two of us. We stare longingly into each other's eyes across cyberspace.
Longingly into each other's webcams.
Oh wait, none of you can see that. So you'll imagine two people staring longingly into each other's webcams. Whether or not we are doing so is... you'll never know.
Are you going to use a lot of illustrative language on this episode here today?
Be prepared for
a visual landscape will unfold before your very eyes.
We will start this visual landscape with audio.
What better way to start?
What better way? As we begin, as we tend to do with Medley's Melodies, the series in which we choose some of our favorite songs from the Legend of Zelda franchise. And today, we go to Skyward Sword. And... oh, what instrument is that? Fi's theme is... you know it the moment you hear it, not just for its introductory notes, but for that instrument that is being used. It's some kind of, like, wood flute, I think.
Oh, the shakuhachi.
Sakuhachi.
Shakuhachi.
Shakuhachi, a traditional Japanese bamboo flute. There we go.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous instrument. It's used a lot in, traditional Japanese music. I've heard it a lot in video game and movie soundtracks over the years, and, I just adore it.
Anytime when you look at Skyward Sword's OST, its soundtrack, I do this every now and again when I'm looking for music to have in the background doing stuff. Skyward Sword in particular has a ton of tracks that are basically the exact same, but only just altered slightly. The first one that comes to that comes up if you're just going down the list is Groose's theme. Groose has like half a dozen different quote-unquote theme songs that are all basically the same thing, but only slightly different depending on what he's doing.
Yeah, because they're scored for the cutscenes that he appears in, so the context of each one of those is slightly different. It's interesting to think, but when you're listening to the soundtrack as a whole, there is a lot of repetition in that way. Mm-hmm.
As we move on to our subject here with Fi's theme, that comes up time and time again throughout the entirety of Skyward Sword, which is actually kind of surprising if you think what most people's opinion of Fi tends to be, which is very monotonous.
But ever present.
But ever present.
As the theme would suggest by being placed in so many different parts of the game, you cannot escape Fi. She will be there.
Now, I love Fi. I am one of those Fi apologists and think that I will assert that if you pay close attention, you will see Fi's development throughout the game. There is a reason why you actually care when she is taking her leave of you at the end of the game.
I mean, maybe you do.
Oh, are you saying you don't?
That's, this tiny anecdote. The first time that I played Skyward Sword, when I reached the end and Fi said her farewells, I'm pretty sure I literally said, thank God. I did not miss her. And, you know, still to this day, I do not miss her.
I cried.
Oh, wow.
I cried and I still cry.
Wow.
There So I wrote a set of video essays back, starting almost 10 years ago now. And I went from the original Zelda all the way up through Skyward Sword, because basically when I finished Skyward Sword, I was like kind of spent on that and I started working on other stuff. I had such a hard time writing Skyward Sword's script because I kept getting really emotional.
Is that so?
It's my favorite in the series, first off, because it gets so emotional. And every time I play it, I tend to tear up, if not outright cry, at Zelda Sacrifice and at Fi's Farewell. And I had the hardest time recording, especially when I was talking about those moments, because my emotions would just keep bubbling up. And I was very proud of myself that I did really, really good. Though I know if I go back and I listen to the finished product, there is a catch where I just barely missed it at the very end when it is, thank you, Master Link. May we meet again in another life. And it's just, oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh, you're going to tear up right now.
Okay.
Honestly, I kind of love the fact that that is in a video, because not only can you go back and see just how it emotionally affected you, but anyone who's paying attention, like you said earlier, would be able to hear that as well. And especially if if it's a passionate video, seeing that passion shine through in the delivery, I think is always appreciated. So
my focus when it comes to gaming as a whole is immersion. And that extends itself into how I am a self-admitted completionist. That's a whole different discussion. And how I get so emotionally invested in games that I play. And I am a lifelong fan of The Legend of Zelda because of that immersion. And that immersion, working in both directions, the game invites you to become a part of its world by how it is constructed. And then I, in turn, because of that, become fully immersed. And so for me, as that kind of emotional person, it is very easy for me to get fully enveloped in whatever is happening in the game. And because Skyward Sword is so story focused, for me, it allows that immersion and those emotions to take hold. When you look at how Fi is constructed, we always see her as this emotionless, robotic type of character, all the percentages, telling you about your battery and all those things. But
yeah,
if you look past just what she is saying and look at everything that is constituted around her, look at the theme. Even without knowing exactly what this instrument is, watch enough Japanese-inspired stuff, you understand that that kind of bamboo flute has always had a connection to the spirits, the spirit world, the spiritual aspect of things. There's a very mystical aura surrounding that instrument. And there is something that I've always found very ethereal and mystical about that. There is something about Fi, about this sword, which we know eventually becomes the Master Sword, the most iconic weapon in gaming, that it just transcends everything that is around you.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I also love getting immersed in games. I like kind of surrendering myself to the experience and letting it drive me in a lot of ways. And The Legend of Zelda has been really good for this in a lot of different installments, in a lot of different ways as well. And I guess something about Skyward Sword, it just felt like the game kind of kept getting in the way of my immersion. So I was never quite able to get to that sort of emotional attachment. So I think there might be, just like a difference of what drives our personal motivations as players, which I think is quite interesting. Personally, as far as this theme goes, I listened to it today. I listened to it yesterday. I honestly could not tell you how it goes because I just don't remember it. Phi is just sort of like, nothing about Phi ever was that intriguing to me. I didn't really feel like reading between the lines because I didn't think that there were lines to be read between, or that whatever it was worth the specific effect that she was having on the gameplay experience. It's one of those things that makes it hard to revisit because then you keep getting reminded about how you keep getting interrupted. So I've always had like this kind of negative association with Phi as sort of like an emblem of the handholding in the Zelda series to its highest degree, in which the game developers won't let me play the game. All I want to do is walk around and look at a tree, and maybe that tree has some cool meaning to it. But if Phi doesn't come out and tell me that this tree has cool meaning to it, it probably doesn't. So it kind of reduces everything in the game to like a binary state, which is fitting for a robot.
Well, if you ever do go back, I would encourage you to take a closer look at how Phi is reacting to the world around you.
Right.
There.
Yeah. I'm not saying by any means that there is not depth.
I totally understand.
Mostly it's just like if there's like subtext to pick up on, I just haven't done that so far. So it's very possible that there's a lot of hidden meaning that I haven't explored or didn't care to explore. Not to say anything about the quality of Phi as a character or her writing, just that she didn't connect with me personally.
Oh, no, I'm not. I am not degrading you of your opinion or saying that you are wrong.
No, I don't think that you are, but I do realize that literally all I've done is write an article saying,
"You're just crapping on Phi, man, stop it."
Literally all I've done so far is write an article that says, "Hey, Zelda 2 is hard, and that's the best thing about it." And then, by the way, I don't like Skyward Sword. So like I'm painting myself to be like a bit of a villain right now, and I just don't want that to be the case.
Don't worry. I am the one who absolutely loves every single Zelda game out there, period. I will fully admit their flaws. I agree the Phi could have been written better. Her writing is subdued on purpose, but it could have been done a little better.
Yeah,
so that
I think
it wasn't
like
so subdued
spot
that you have to like stare at it with a microphone glass, magnifying glass to get there.
Yeah, there is a sweet spot between, you know, I think a great example of this is Data from Star Trek The Next Generation. He's a robot, but he feels like a person. His writing is so intriguing in the interactions that he has with all of the different crew members and the ways that he tries to understand the minutiae of their day-to-day lives and their little rituals that, as a computer, he cannot process. And it just kind of leaves him with all of these questions because he wants to know everything and know what everyone is doing and what the meaning behind things are. And so then, you know, there's like the episode where he he reads poetry and everyone's falling asleep because a robot writing poetry is like, there's fun stuff that you can do with that concept. And it just seemed like playing Fi so one note is not necessarily the best way to endear players to her.
I will say that Data does have the advantage of being part of a very long running series. He has more time. And also that was the whole point of his character, was a robot trying to comprehend humanity.
100%. But like, I just wanted to say that, you know, that's just an example of how you can do a character like that. I don't mean that Fi necessarily should be exactly like Lieutenant Commander Data, although a Zelda game where Brent Spiner follows you around sounds like a good time to me. It's just like,
Captain,
that's
something. I believe there is a 35% chance that this statical adherence would not be perfectly in line with our options.
Honestly,
perhaps it would be better if we were to attack this from a different mode of perspective.
Honestly, I would. I'm just putting this as a call out there. If anybody wants to make a ROM hack of Skyward Sword where you replace Fi with Lieutenant Commander Data, I will play it. I will love it. That'll be the way that I love Skyward Sword, is being followed around by Data. You can have that one for free, guys.
Oh, gosh.
But as far as the actual theme itself goes, Fi's theme is lovely. It's pretty. I don't think it's like amazing. But it's cute. My favorite part of the article, actually, that we're discussing is all of the different motifs that it talks about, the ways that it has been used in different games, like the Master Sword Trials and Tears of the Kingdom and things like that. I straight up, you heard me say I don't remember what Fi's theme sounds like, so you'll be not at all surprised to learn that I did not notice that it was Fi's theme that was playing during these sections. And watching these things back and listening back to the soundtracks with that in mind, I thought it was really interesting, actually, and really cool how something like that could kind of be hidden in plain sight, even for someone who has played through Skyward Sword multiple times.
I gotta remember to get you and Caden on the same podcast together. He's a band director, and so you can have all three of us just talking music shop.
Sounds great. So I love that.
Well, thank you so much to Will Nelson for drawing our attention to Fi's theme here in Medley's Melodies. And we move on now to The Bomber's Notebook, the series where we take a special look at the various and unique characters found in the Legend of Zelda series. And if we want to talk about unique characters, important characters, it's hard to get more important than the goddesses who shaped Hyrule and the entirety of the Triforce. We're taking a focus at Din, the goddess of power, as introduced in Ocarina of Time.
Good old Din has been used in many games since, but I think this was the first appearance of the name Din in the series?
This is the first time that the goddesses as a trio were ever named.
Yes.
And the ethos, the mythos of Hyrule really got its start truly in A Link to the Past. This is where the Triforce had its position, not just as some magical artifact, but as a basically the cornerstone to the foundations of Hyrule and the world that it exists in. And then, in Ocarina of Time, that mythos is given a cinematic touch, where we are introduced via cutscene to the literal formation of everything as told by the Great Deku Tree. And Din is the one that starts it off by forming the land upon which we stand.
I really loved that cutscene as a kid, mostly just because on the goddesses themselves and on the Triforce itself, when it shows up, it's got that peak N64 shiny texture work going on for it. And there's something about that that always just looks so, so satisfying to me. I could watch, I would get the spiritual stones and the medallions and just watch them spin around for a while because they were so fun to look at.
Who says Ocarina of Time is outdated?
I don't think Ocarina of Time is outdated. I think there are still lessons that modern games can learn from Ocarina of Time.
It's so good.
Yeah, but as far as Din goes, it's interesting to think about, you know, the origins of Hyrule, but also it's like not really that important to the story of Ocarina of Time. It's sort of just like Deku Tree tells you about the birds and the bees, and then you go off and fight Ganon, you know? It's just like, it's just a non sequitur, basically.
Okay, the fact that you decided to choose birds and the bees in a game where Link literally skips puberty.
You know what? That's, yeah. I didn't even think of that, but. Yeah. One thing I did think was interesting when reading this through is thinking about Din and, you know, her initial appearance as just one of the identical goddesses of Hyrule, later being personified, later being more of a character in her own right. And oftentimes, interestingly enough, the article goes into a good amount of detail on, you know, the Gorons and how the element of power would be associated with the Gorons and things like that. But interestingly, Din seems to be portrayed as a Gerudo in most of the other games, which I thought was interesting just based on, you know, the fact that Ganon is also a Gerudo and he has the Triforce of Power. So, like, maybe, I don't know. What if Hyrule was an inside job?
Oh my gosh.
We do
need to be careful that we don't merge too deeply the goddess Din and the oracle Din. The Oracle of Seasons is a different entity from the goddess, even though they share the same name. We do need to be careful there.
But I mean, who's because like
that?
Still,
that being,
you know?
Said, you do bring up an interesting point in that the oracle Din does look very Gerudo-esque. And Din being representative of the force of power, which is usually associated with Ganondorf, who is at least in one iteration Gerudo in background as well, there is certainly some inspirations, if not outright connections, that you could probably get to. I feel like Din, because she holds the Triforce of Power, which is always ending up in the hands of the villain in one form or another,
yeah,
probably ends up with kind of a bad rap in Hylian mythology.
Yeah, but because like also, you gotta be more careful about who you give that to. It's the Triforce of Power.
She's,
dude,
not the one giving it. It's not her choice. I hate the chosen by destiny, as if it's like, yes, destiny chose it. That means Ganondorf was always supposed to have it. It's like, see it, but if the same person is always getting the same Triforce, you're creating an unfair association here.
But like, Link is always the one who gets the Triforce of Courage, and Zelda's always the one who gets the Triforce of Wisdom. But you don't call it unfair when it's them. I call that a double standard, a triple standard, even.
Well, here's the thing. If you go to Skyward Sword, the game that you have already been besmirching. No. the thing about the Triforce as a whole, and this is where we get into the same thing in regards to the, I'm going to draw a parallel here with the goddesses here. The Triforce as a whole can only be fully utilized by someone whose heart is pure and balanced in with all three of these, at least as far as Hyrule is concerned, primordial forces of power, wisdom, and courage.
Virtues, the three virtues, maybe?
The three virtues of life. I don't know. Anywho.
Unity, duty, and destiny.
Oh, gosh. Now we just need to change the U to another D, and we can have triple Ds. D-D-D. Oh, no, that's Kirby.
Anyway. That was a Bionicle joke for anyone who's listening.
Sorry, I was too old for Bionicle.
But it says right here, I'm reading this part in the article. As part of their legend, each goddess left a snippet of their power behind through the creation of the Triforce. Din is responsible for the Triforce of Power, a piece that ends up in the hands of Ganondorf. Ganondorf uses her power to bring Hyrule to ruin and destroy all she worked to create. In the wrong hands, power easily corrupts, and while it is said that the gods chose the wielders of the gift they leave behind, the Triforce wasn't the only gift Din left behind. So we learn that, yes, Din did choose who to give it to.
No, that's they left behind, not the one that she specifically told it. Here's the thing.
It is
yes,
said the gods Link chose the wielders of the gift they left behind.
It is said. It didn't say that it did. If you look at Ocarina of Time's text from the Sheikah legend, it says chosen by destiny, not chosen by the gods.
Oh, I see. The gods don't have anything to do with destiny, I'm sure.
Who does have control of destiny?
That's a great question.
That is very much a philosophical question that we're not here for.
If I had to guess, in the world of Zelda, I'd probably give it the gods would be the ones who'd control destiny. But that's just me.
Unless the gods left that power for the humans.
Which was a terrible, terrible idea.
And yet, that is what they have done. At least according to Zelda, who describes this in Skyward Sword. Again, here's the thing with the Triforce. You have these primordial elements that can only call forth the true power of the gods when they are in unity. The Triforce was hidden away, yes, to keep evil forces from obtaining it, but also to provide the situation so that a human could one day successfully wield the Triforce in its entirety. Link starts out as the embodiment of courage, sent out for whatever reason to save the world in an unknown, terrifying land. But through his adventures, he gains both the power and the wisdom to balance out his courage and thus create a unified whole that can then effectively use the Triforce in its entirety, while someone who is only obsessed with power obtains that which he so desires, which is just power.
Absolutely. The only reason I bring any of this up is because I just, while I was reading this article, I just got this idea that wouldn't it be fun for a Zelda game to, you know, switching things up from the classic Ganon is the bad guy, Link is the good guy. What if, you know, the tables turn a little bit and it turns out that the gods are like plotting against the people for whatever reason, or maybe just one of the gods is kind of plotting against the others. And it just seems like having a different sort of conflict would do the series well at this point in time. And you could do worse than, you know, the gods are crazy. Let's go.
That was a funny movie.
Yeah, the gods must be crazy.
The god must be crazy. As much as I enjoy a good JRPG let's kill god plot, The one leap in logic that has always amused me about all of those plots is if you are God, why are you messing around? You're a freaking deity. You can crush all of us with a thought.
Oh, absolutely.
Stop it.
No, I don't think that I don't think that a let's go kill God plot would be what the series needs. If anything, that would make it appear to be in a worse state than ever. But yeah, just the idea that, like, I don't know, maybe the gods are fallible. Maybe they made a mistake. Maybe they're trying to own up to that mistake and make up for it. That could also be a cool idea. It's just like sort of a jumping off point to start exploring other ideas. Just thought it was worth bringing up.
a point in your favor, you know, on that. The one time we know the gods really took control in their own hands, they flooded the whole flipping planet.
It's true.
So there you go.
Yeah. So
well, thank
yeah.
you. Thank you, Caitlin Druitt, for opening this page of the Bomber's Notebook to us. And we're going to move on to a segment that we have yet to explore here on the podcast. We are coming over to Tetris Treasures, a series that shines a spotlight on uncommon Zelda merchandise and memorabilia. You can look at Zelda-related figurines, clothes, replicas, and everything in between. What we're shedding light on today comes from 1988, and that is The Legend of Zelda board game. Amazing. If you're watching us over here on YouTube, we'll make sure to bring up some of the images we have, just a couple, in regards to what this game itself is supposed to look like. You can see that it was published by Milton Bradley, probably the most famous of board game publishers. So games like Monopoly, Sorry, Candyland, these are all Milton Bradley type of games. And they made a Legend of Zelda game back in 88.
Feels like everything was getting a tie-in board game around that time. That was around the time of the Ninja Turtles Pizza Power board game as well. The Street Fighter board game.
I don't remember the Street Fighter one. I remember the Ninja Turtle one, vaguely.
The Street Fighter board game is real. And it is not very good.
Well, I imagine it's probably just about as good as this front cover artwork. I don't know why both Link and Princess Zelda look so incredibly pudgy.
They look like, you know when Mario gets hit and he turns into small Mario? That's like if Link got hit and he turned into small Link.
They look like Cabbage Patch Kids.
Yeah, they really do. Like Cabbage Patch
really
Hobbits.
Do.
The article
yes,
actually
they're hobbits.
Yeah, the article actually does compare them to hobbits, and I would agree that they are really, especially Link, is looking quite hobbity.
Oh my gosh!
But I honestly like this artwork a lot. I love the pose on Link on the raft. I think is great. The way it kind of overlaps the left side of the box, I think is great. Mm-hmm. I love the way that the Zolas look, and the Tektite is, he's just kind of, they don't fly through the air like that, but.
They don't, but he's probably jumping. He's in mid-jump.
I like to think that, like, a pea hat dropped him, and he's, like, doing a dive bomb attack.
Better yet, they're already taking inspiration from a game 40 years in the future, and a Moblin chucked it.
Oh, amazing. That would be amazing. Yeah, the Moblin is just... He's on the back of the box, I'm sure.
Right next to the instructions.
Yeah, a Milton Bradley housed artist signed Talbot. You collected a darn fine paycheck there, Talbot. Good work.
Thank you, Talbot. It's, you know, we complain in this day and age about these big companies trying to milk every single penny they can from every single popular IP, everything getting a game and a movie and a drink and everything with no respect to what it's coming from. This isn't new, people.
You want,
they have
yeah,
been doing
you want to act
this
like this was any
forever.
Different. Nintendo Serial System was a thing. The Legend of Zelda cartoon was a thing. I actually have a The Legend of Zelda cartoon on TVT.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, I watched the whole thing with my partner a year or two ago. And you know what? This might be a controversial opinion. It's not very good. And I imagine the same could maybe be said for the Zelda board game, which I have never played. But I apologize to the people who designed the Zelda board game, but it doesn't really look like I'm missing out on a ton.
Well, let's take a quick look here at what is involved
So I watched a video of someone who was just kind of played through the game and showed how it went. So I do kind of remember what the rule set is.
Okay.
If you'll allow me. So basically, everyone, it's 1 to 4 players. You can play this on your own. There are 4 attack dice that you have when you get in battles. And when you add an additional player, they just roll their own dice. So if you have 4 players, everybody rolls 1 die to decide what the attack roll is. And you have 1 movement die. So everyone shares this one link, little cardboard cutout looking guy. And you move different spaces to land on these yellow square tiles. On every world, as they're called, there are a successive amount of tiles. So in world 1, there would be like 3 tiles. World 3, there's 5, something like that. And you have to flip over these tiles until you find the item that's in the center between the 2 worlds. So in world 1, you got to find the fairy. So you got to roll around, you know, roll 2, move up to the square tile, flip one over. It's an enemy. Now you have to fight the enemy. If you win, sometimes he'll have a little heart icon and you collect the heart. The goal is to get as many hearts as you can. That's your score. If you're playing solo, that's your high score. If you're playing competitively, you tally it up, but you lose a heart when you take damage. So under one of these tiles, there's that fairy, but you got to kind of wander around each world until you find it. Some of them, there's only 3 tiles. It's not that hard, but there's more tiles that get introduced as the game goes on. So that's the loop.
Okay. You know, as far as a game concept goes, that's not too bad.
Yeah, it's an interesting way of gamifying an exploration and combat style game like Zelda in a board game format. I just had like a couple. These are things that I would have to, you know, actually get my hands on the game to play myself. But I was also thinking like, it seems, you know, like if you. It seems like there's a lot of backtracking for it being a board game, but there's only, you know...
It's Zelda, of course there's backtracking.
But there's only, you know, intersecting directions every so often. So it's pretty linear, all things considered. You only have the choice between going in 2 directions, essentially.
True.
So, you know, just going back and forth along 1 line or 2 lines is maybe a little bit less interesting than having more freedom to move around and kind of optimize your movement. I was thinking of Clue while I was looking at this board. You know how Clue has like the hallways that have multiple tiles on them and you can kind of move wherever you want. I was thinking,
were to modernize this game, give it an update, what would we change about the board game to make it more appealing or at the very least make it work in this day and age?
First thing I would do is update the artwork.
I
will say I really like the artwork for World 3. I think it looks great, but because of the way the game is played, you have to place face down tiles on the artwork. So you're not going to get to see it anyway. So it doesn't really matter if it looks good or not. So there's one thing that we can focus on to try not to obscure the artwork. I was thinking, like, very specifically, you could just start with Clue, but every room is a dungeon.
I was thinking along the same lines. Started with a kind of a Clue setup, but instead of being like, okay, I'm going to go over to the conservatory, or I'm going to go to the dining room. Instead, you don't necessarily know what is in each area, and so you may wander to a location and you flip over the card and it's, oh, I am in Kakariko Village.
Yeah.
Or I'll go over here. This is where Kakariko was last time. Oh, now it's the Great Deku Tree.
Yeah.
And that will change the environment and the things that you have to do while you're in that location.
And I was
so you go in, you discover you have entered the Great Deku Tree area, and you see, I have to be careful because I've always made fun of those quote unquote European style board games that have way too many pieces for their own good.
Oh, yeah.
And so you basically have to learn a whole new tabletop role-playing system in order to play this board game. And I don't want to go that crazy.
That's why I'm kind of starting with Clue as a baseline, because it's like pretty easy to pick up and play, you know?
Yeah.
I was thinking like it could be cool. We could reuse the concept of the encounter tiles from this board game.
Okay.
And just kind of scatter them in various places around like the hallways, as they are known in Clue. And, you know, maybe you fight a monster, maybe you get some rupees, maybe you get an item or something like that. But you're going to want to hit them sometimes when you are feeling good, but maybe not when you're low on health. And maybe there are like some choke points where it's kind of inevitable that you might get into an encounter, and kind of, just in encourage different kinds of play atmospheres like that. It could be interesting.
We should have it like Breath of the Wild, Tears of the Kingdom, in which you know where Ganondorf is.
Oh.
And you can go and challenge him at any time. But if you go through the hassle of exploring and picking up different items and health and stuff, you'll fare a better chance of winning.
It's actually a really good idea is to use the weapon durability system from Breath of the Wild. Have some of the items you pick up be weapons that are like, you know, three uses of this weapon or something. So
you could do that, or
like
at the very least
cards in your hand that have like, oh, this sword does one damage and this one does like three damage, and you'd have to kind of pick and choose which ones you want to use based on the encounter that you're in. That
we could also use the dice that they have for the game. So if
that's
you
true.
Go and you're doing stuff, you collect more dice that you get to use in your attacks.
Well, I mean, how many dice are you going to have?
I don't know. It just kind of depends. That's where you do your whole play testing and figure out the balance for the game.
But like that, and we're just spitballing about this, but I think like the main takeaway from all this is that there is a cool idea in here, and even if it's not necessarily the most fleshed out and it's kind of like a pretty bland implementation of the idea, I really enjoy the way they approached the issue of gamifying Zelda to be a board game. I like the fact that you go into a different worlds is cool, but it doesn't really have much bearing on the actual game besides which kind of monsters you encounter. So in World 2, you're going to encounter Zolas. And in World 1, you're going to encounter Tektites. And there's, you know, things like that. But there's more that could be done with that, too, you know? There's
always more. Chances are, as we were discussing before, this is not our current day and age is not the first time in which companies have been trying to take advantage of whatever's popular in the moment to shell out some kind of
it's true
crap thing and hence for an attempt for money.
It's true.
So
and it's, you know, some of these attempts went over better than others. I think most of the attempts for Zelda back in the 80s didn't really pan out well, but this is
insert
like a cool
CDI
artifact.
Joke here.
The CDI games are also a cool artifact, but this board game is a cool artifact that I kind of wish I was able to play, because even if it doesn't sound that engaging, the idea of a potentially single player or cooperative four player adventure board game is like kind of interesting, you know?
It is. There is a cool concept to be had here. And as someone who has worked with role-playing games and trying to adapt stuff to different kinds of systems, that rings true to my kind of experience. Well, thank you so much to Derek Yarworth for bringing this piece of hidden historical treasure to Tetris Hold. And now, we interrupt this game for a new player. Jason, I put you on mute if you would like to demute yourself.
I believe it's unmute.
How you doing, guys?
I like demute.
Demute is good, too.
Demuted.
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 It's like demoted.
Except better.
Except better, yeah.
You have been demuted, Jason.
Appreciate it.
Welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys. Thank you.
Just in time to discuss our main feature of the month and the reason Alex has been brought onto the podcast in the first place. We've discussed this a couple of times on the podcast. I am the old one here, while everyone else is younger by certain...
I'm sure we're up there with you, buddy. 80s babies.
Okay. So at least
I'm a 90s.
Hey, you were still up there with us.
There we go.
Still up there with us.
I'm still up there.
Up there, but not too quite, because at the very least, Jason and I are old enough to remember when basically every video game in existence was hard.
Oh yes.
Like unfathomably hard.
Yes.
If you have a Switch, take some time to mess around with your freely provided NES Virtual Console, and you will discover just how unnecessarily difficult every single game was back in the day.
And try beating those same games without that rewind feature.
Yeah.
Try beating it without the rewind feature, and you will know our pain.
I was about 4 or 5, I want to say, when I first had the dexterity and the awareness to play the Nintendo Entertainment System on my own. And I don't know why we had it. I don't know why my parents bought it, but they did. And we did have, in our very small NES library, the original Legend of Zelda and Zelda 2, The Adventure of Link. The only reason I got anywhere in the first game was because there was the instruction booklet that had a map to tell you where the first and second dungeons were. And Zelda 2 is the only game that I have ever rage quit.
Oh, no.
Because Zelda 2
understandable.
Is a nightmare.
Understandable.
I can't say I don't understand.
I did not successfully complete either of those games until high school, and that was thanks to ROMs and emulators and the save function.
Did you have the manual for Zelda 2 when you were a kid?
I had both of them, yeah.
I mean,
You had both.
Yeah, I had the manual, too.
Because, sometimes... I would say,
the manual does not help you beat Zelda
2. No, not at all. Not at all. It just kind of gives you an insight. That's it. And it's funny because, I don't know... to be fair, I beat those games when I was younger, too. You know, like 6, 7, whatever. But for Zelda...
Okay, now you're just showing off.
No, I'm not.
I did not beat those games.
Because I didn't...
No, I did not beat those games until I was in college.
Not even showing off, because I had my games that I quit. Like, for me, my demon that I chased for years was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for Nintendo. I never beat that until I was older.
I don't think I...
Never beat it. I came close, but I never beat it until I got older.
I have beaten it with save states only. Yeah. I have not beaten that one.
Yeah, I couldn't beat that one. I couldn't beat Batman, the one I was based off the movie.
Oh my god, Batman is impossible.
Yeah, I got the Joker every time,
so
but I couldn't beat it.
But it's so...
Until I got older. Yeah,
Joker is impossible.
Yeah. But
I'll beat it one of these days.
But Zelda was the one... game that I really enjoyed, so I worked hard on it, but I had help. Like, I had an older babysitter who, she was just like a god when it came to gaming. Like, you remember when the Mario Brothers had the little one-up, not say glitch, but exploit where you can get them on the stairs and you could do the unlimited one-up jump? She was the first one I ever saw in my life to do that, like, with little to no effort. You know what I mean? So I had help beating Zelda 1, in Zelda 2. Like, I at least had someone that kind of said, oh, you could look here. But she would make me work for it. Like, what do you think this would do? Or what do you think that would do? Because there was no way I was finding that town that you had to chop down with the wood, with the little hammer or axe. There was no way I was finding that without Hope. There was no way.
It's a hammer. It's not an axe.
Yeah, there was no way I was finding that. But I...
Guess what? The manual tells you that you can use it to cut down trees.
Yeah, if you read it again. Yeah, exactly. But, like, still, like, to find that town... It was the town that I had a hard time with, and I think finding the grave that you fall down into the passageway. But
well, because they say head to the king's grave and then head south, and if you go into the king's grave and then head directly south, you'll just fall into it.
But I,
it's true.
So they, it is a helpful game in a lot of ways.
It is one. Okay, so some historical. Context. That's the word. Historical context. So it should come as no surprise that Nintendo, as a company, when it came to video games, before they had their home console, they had designed arcade cabinets. Yeah. The original, like Mario Brothers, the original Donkey Kong, those were arcade games.
I've played those too.
And eventually they were just transferred over to their home console when they actually made the NES or the Famicom. And if you have ever spent any time in an arcade, what is the point of an arcade cabinet?
It's to make money.
Yeah.
To make money.
Yeah. Sad but true.
So all of those classic arcade games, those fighting games, the Simpsons battle arcade thingy, all of those things, they were there to eat your quarters.
And they did.
Which means they had to make those games as difficult as humanly possible.
Yep.
Yeah.
The same that same kind of mindset transfers over to when they're making their first home games. Also, considering the fact that you are working with games whose data capacity is less than that of a picture on your phone.
Yeah.
They're working with mere kilobytes of data. And so if you have a game that is as quote-unquote easy as, we'll say, Ocarina of Time or Twilight Princess, they are comparatively easy.
Comparatively.
I think we
by far.
Oh, absolutely.
Even easier than Link to the Past.
They're designed so that you can actually get
through.
Imagine getting through something that comparatively easy in as much data as that provides. You would be done with it in an hour and be like, okay, now
exactly.
What?
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And so suddenly there's replay value to the game in the overcoming of the challenge. Yeah.
Not to mention, you know, back then it was a little different. You know, they didn't have the social media and everything about it. Word of mouth was the strongest thing by far, if not, you know, television and whatnot. So when you had friends that said, oh, I got this game, you know, and it's the best game, but I can't beat it. And it's like, oh, well, let me come over and let me try to beat it, or let me get the game. And how far did you get? And, you know. And there was a lot of back and forth because, you know, back then, if you could beat games like that, you were kind of, you know, you kind of held on a pedestal a little bit amongst friends. You know, it's like, oh, no, this dude beat Zelda 2, or this dude could beat, you know, Turtles, or you know what I mean? So it's like it kind of also like made the experience more genuine and better. Like, you remember that movie? I know I'm telling my age when I say this. Was it called The Wizard?
The Wizard?
Yeah. You remember how it was?
With Fred Savage.
Yeah, remember how it was with him when being good at Mario 3 was like legit their ticket to like a better life, you know what I mean? And
absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
That was real for us back then, you know? It and so, you know, making those games hard and challenging kind of set Nintendo on a road down, you know, like a journey of being, you know, something that you wanted to deal with, or like, oh wow, Nintendo games are great. They're also challenging. Let's see if we can beat it, you know. So those were good times, man. I really enjoyed those days.
Yeah, because like when something's difficult, but you want to play, you're gonna keep playing it. Whereas if you can just breeze through it, no worries, then you're probably not even gonna think much about it. You just be like, okay, that didn't really take much effort.
Exactly.
But if you actually have to lock in and pay attention and be aware of your situations and make plans and execute plans and stuff like that, that's engagement. Yeah. And engagement is the thing that gets people addicted to games.
Exactly.
And I think that difficulty can, not is always, but it can be a huge motivator for people in that way, because there are so many games that people play nowadays that are comparatively like little effort. Yeah. You know, you don't really have to think twice about dying in a new Mario game, but you really did have to think twice about dying in an old Mario game when that meant that you had to redo like three levels or something like that. Maybe even more, maybe the whole game, you know?
And I think that's also what I love about, you know, like Connor was saying, you know, when the Zelda games started getting easier, I feel like they got too easy at a point. And I'm glad that at least with the Breath of the Wild series, they started to move that challenge back to how Zelda was and how gaming was. And I know at first they were probably nervous about it, but as it's shown, people loved that Zelda Breath of the Wild was challenging. You know, how many people shared how many times they died, how different ways they died. Oh, I beat a Lionel today. You know, I didn't die from a guardian. And you know, it kind of fostered a lot more like, nuance and basically brought a lot more gamers in that probably wouldn't have played a Zelda game. But it's like, oh, I heard this game is hard, but people aren't worried about that. They still like to play the game. And especially in this whole era where like Death Souls and then a lot of the newer game or Dark Souls, sorry. Dark Souls. Like
they should make a game called Death Souls. That sounds like right up their alley.
There's probably one on the Switch eShop. It's like $1.
Oh god, don't even give me started on that. but yeah, like
free on Steam today.
But yeah, like you see how now like the bringing the challenge back doesn't kill a game. And I think Nintendo's starting to understand that. So, because, you know, all the new games that come out that, like, are challenging, like the Expedition 33 or, like, the Souls-type games, like, people are enjoying these games. It's not how it was maybe even, 10 years ago when, like, you know, I love Skyward Sword, but Skyward Sword held your hand so much. And, you know, I think...
Yeah, we were having that discussion.
Yeah.
It's true. We did. We got into the weeds a little bit.
Yeah. I won't go that far, but like, yeah, it is refreshing to see that at least gaming is returning back to that. Like, okay, the game may be hard, the game may be challenging, but let's give it a try. Even casual players who aren't like, you know, probably as diehard as some of us hardcore gamers are, you know, they're willing to play these games and give it a shot, and they're being rewarded because, you know, like I said, some people have been, I know people that be in Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom that by no means would play Souls or any of these games like how we played and do well at them, and they're able to like get far or beat it or get to a point where they feel like a sense of accomplishment, and that's amazing, like that we have that now in this age, you know.
Yeah, it's because the game, well, Breath of the Wild is great as an example of what the strength of a Zelda game is, especially when you consider what a Zelda game that's difficult is, because on a basic fundamental level, Breath of the Wild gives you a challenge, and it also gives you, if not the tools to overcome it, then the means by which to procure those tools to overcome it. So it's up to you, basically, how much you engage with the game and on what level you meet those challenges. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There is a huge safety net in Breath of the Wild because you can get so many heart containers.
I know.
And you can carry around so many potions. But if you don't want to get all those heart containers, you don't have to. And if you don't want to carry around potions or engage with the cooking at all, you don't have to. You can meet it on whatever level you want to. And I think it just speaks to a lot of people.
How you create investment is the number one question that you have to answer if you are trying to make any kind of initiative happen. I speak of this in terms of gaming. I speak of this in terms of what I do for my job, which is very volunteer driven. And any kind of initiative, government program, new product, all of these things require buy-in from the people that they're trying to, for lack of a better phrase, market it to. And so how do you make a new product, a new activity, how do you make that attractive to the people that you're trying to sell it to? And there's a lot of ways you can do that. If you've taken time to look at Sakurai's YouTube channel, where he's talked about all the things he's learned in regards to gaming, one of his earlier videos talks about the essence of gaming. What is gaming at its core, particularly when it comes to video games? And it essentially boils down to a risk-reward type of scenario. How close can I get to a thing that is dangerous in order to get the desired outcome and how close you are willing to get and how good are those results. That interplay creates the essence of video games as a whole. There are a ton of games, quote unquote, out there that are just lazy farm simulators.
And that is perfectly fine. Started.
If you want to have fun with things like build your Everybody own sandbox thing in Minecraft or Animal Crossing, whatever it is that you want to do, that is an Pokemon. Awesome, fun time for you to have. But when it comes to the actual essence of game, this is the kind of stuff that we're talking to. There's a reason why competitive sports, for example, are the biggest entertainment draw just in terms of sheer numbers, because that kind of push and pull is intricate and it is integral to the human condition's desire, as it were.
But like, I don't want you talking like farming simulators don't have any risk reward scenarios in them. You gotta make sure you know what season the crops have to grow in and how long you have to grow them for, how many you should plant, how many you can water per day. You have to know what kind of fertilizer you have to use in your field to get the specific crops grades that you want. You gotta make sure that you have... you're selling enough product to be able to afford the seeds you need for the next season. You have to stockpile enough stuff so that you have ingredients. Like, there's so much stuff to a farming simulator that is absolutely risk versus reward. I was playing Harvest Moon, Friends of Mineral Town, a little while back, and I just planted so many crops without any regard for the fact that it was going to literally take me all day to water them. And so every day, all I did was water the crops. And anytime it rained, I thought, God has blessed me. I can go into the town and talk to people. And so, but after it was all said and done, I had this awesome field full of great crops. And then I was able to upgrade my watering can and do more stuff like that. But that was like,
eventually you'll have enough for a combine harvester.
Exactly right.
This is like, literally farming simulator. But this explains why every year I've been at PAX West, I have literally seen Farming Simulator 23, 24, 25. There's like, actual demand for this for some reason. Like, go be a farmer, dang it, if you're that invested in this game.
I just don't want there to be any illusions about what real gaming, quote unquote, is. And whether that's exclusionary of casual games or cozy games or anything like that, because there are a lot of factors in these games. There is a reason that people get enjoyment and addiction and engagement out of these things.
We do not support addiction here, by the way. We do not want you addicted to anything.
Well, I don't want to addict anybody to games, but especially in terms of like casual games and stuff like that, that's like a legitimate thing. So there's got to be something that's bringing these people back, you know?
I mean, honestly, I feel like, you know, in my eyes, real gaming is whatever people enjoy, you know? And as long as it's not something where it's, you know, too predatory on your wallet or your time investment or whatever.
When you actually feel like you're getting something out of the experience.
Yeah, exactly. And I played farming sim games. I played Harvest. I played, you know, Animal Crossing and stuff like that. So I know the appeal that's there. You know, I just think it's like, it depends on what you come in. And like I said, me and Connor, we come from that hardcore 80s NES days where the majority of our games was trying to, you know, get to, you know, the last level with Bowser and
trying to not die.
Yeah, or Zelda 2. Listen, Zelda 2 challenged me so much as a kid because, like, I did have at least one other friend that did beat it too, and I was trying to, like, oh, let me be like him, you know, and it was hard, man, like, you know, back then, but it spurred something in me so that, like, games that came after and since, like, I don't ever have a problem beating a game because I've already had that challenge when I was younger to, you know, evolve to whatever the challenge was. A lot of it is for games like that is like, you know, not just knowledge and puzzles, you know, But it's like, you know, learning your control, your skill when it comes to like moving your character and stuff. Like some of those fights in Zelda 2, like you can be as good as you want. If you don't know how to jump tech at the right time, you're not beating it. You know what I mean? Like
you got to know the arc of the jump and how much reach you have with your sword.
Listen, yo, when I used to style on bubbles and catch that down thrust in that perfect position, hold down to destroy that thing. Like
that's my favorite thing.
Yeah, your brain just like evolves. Like, it's funny too because like for my stream, every now and then I go back and play some classics for my chat, and I went back and played Zelda 2, and I did Zelda 1 and Zelda 2 marathon in like one night, and they were just like amazed, like, how do you know this game so well? And I'm like, I've been playing this since I was like 6 and 7. Like, you know, I played these games without the rewind feature, without the save states, you know. Absolutely. So it's like, this just makes it even easier. And I remember one time I did a stream with like, I use rewind, and so it was like I would go do something, maybe mess up, and I'll just bloop, 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 and go right through. And they're like, oh my God. I'm like, this is how easy it is. But even still, like, I had people say, like, you know, I can't even beat this with the rewind feature.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I'm like,
you
know,
it is so far. I really adopted the darkness. I was born in it. Born in it.
Yep.
Oh my God. Zelda 2 is like a really it's an interesting game in that
I love
way.
It. That's
like
one of my favorites.
Yeah, yeah. Because, like, exactly like you were saying, you know, you have to you got to get the movement of the character down and use that to your advantage. Again, the manual is helpful for this kind of thing. If you read it, it tells you about your player movement and the fact that you're going to need to, you know, look for enemy attack patterns and figure out the best way of dealing with every enemy. And oftentimes, if you mess around enough, you will find the best way of dealing with the enemy. And then every single time you encounter that enemy and you just wipe it out like it's nothing, it feels incredible because such a huge challenge at an earlier point.
In my time playing games, for the most part, I have avoided the Dark Souls like games for two primary reasons. One, it's always seemed so gritty to me.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
The environment is way too gritty for my personal aesthetics. And the other reason is that everything always seems so slow, particularly your character seems really, really slow. The pace of play just never really seems to work out for me. I've realized that Zelda 2 actually really fits my preferred pace of play. My character is a nimble character. I can jump back and forth. I can move back. And the controls are really responsive in that way. I see something that's coming. I don't have to have seen it coming 3 seconds ago in order to get out of the way. I can react and jump. And that's a lot.
But the game is balanced around that movement. So the game knows that you're nimble and that you can jump. And it says, oh, okay, you can jump. So you better.
Not even that. Remember this, and this is where I was also saying, like, why some people have a hard time with that game, even with the Orion feature. Remember, like, the levels where you have to cross the bridges and it'd be like the bubbles coming up from the bottom, the skull Flying heads fish. Coming from. Yeah.
Skull
and
fish.
Those patterns are not by any means predictable. They're random based on how you
those
even
bubbles
move.
More than anything else. I can live with the fish. It's the bubbles.
But and so that's like, also like the way that the game tests your knowledge of the movement. So it says, okay, so are you good enough at the movement that if we just throw something that we just throw
crazy stuff at you, can you deal with it?
Like, can you still deal with it? And you can if you know the movement well enough.
Yeah, and it's funny too. Like, Connor, you would be good at a Souls game just because of your background, but I get it though, because before I played them, they did look slow and clunky to me. But once you get used to the engine and how it is, it would actually be a lot easier than you think. But I understand the aesthetic because I don't like too much of a gritty aesthetic, even though I've played them. I don't prefer it though. Like, you know me, I'm more of a Zelda guy, like, you know, Warriors game, stuff like that. So I'm, you know, I like, you know, you could be dark and tough, but not like extra bloody or extra like, you know, zombie-rific, zombie-rific, yeah. You know. But those games, I like them because of how they challenge you. You know what I mean? Like, you know it's going to be a hard game. And it gives me the same feel that it gave that Nintendo games gave me back in the day where, like, you know, you had one hit and you would be dead. You know, two hits and you'd be dead. You know, and I think that's why I like games like that, because it really reminds me of, like, the older games, just like how Zelda 2 was. You know, it gives me that same sense of, like, accomplishment to beat it. But it also gives me that same feeling of, like, yo, this is hard. So, you know, sit up in your chair a little bit.
Exactly. It's interesting to talk about the Souls games as a bit of a point of comparison, because similarly to how Zelda 2 is designed with player movement in mind, with all of the encounters and enemies, Dark Souls is the exact same way. It's because Zelda 2 is nimble and fast. Everything comes at you and you got to react to it. But in Dark Souls, you typically have, like, a bit more time to react to things. Enemies move a bit slower. That's more so sometimes true of, like, the first couple games. It gets a little bit. But then also the player movement gets snappier as the games go on, right? So it always strikes that balance. It's just interesting because those are, like, the same core ideas about player movement versus enemy movement that are kind of resonant in both games. And that's such an easy balance to get wrong. How many games, especially old Nintendo games, have you played where you just can't react to the enemies because they're too fast for you?
Yeah, they're going crazy.
Yeah.
I think that's something else. Battletoads is a great example. Remember Battletoads and Double Dragon? That was fun. Oh my god, those games are I love. But the other thing I love about, you know, Zelda 2 is I feel like it really solidified the whole dungeons for me. You know, maybe even more so if not as much as, like, Zelda 1. As far as, like, the exploration, because some of the dungeons in Zelda 2, like, you know, you can go through them in, like, 2-3 minutes, and then other ones it's like, if you get turned around, you'll be in there for a while.
Yeah, where was this key? You know? Where did I need to use this key again?
You know, and I love that because it really forced me to, like, pay attention. And also, too, which is funny, because Zelda 2 doesn't have a map for the dungeons.
Nope. No.
So you're, like, literally in there, like, oh, okay, I better pay attention where I'm at. Like, I remember I used to draw the little, like, okay, go left here, go right here.
Yeah.
You know, to kind of, like, remind me and stuff.
I can't believe I never, ever thought about drawing maps on my own.
Like I said, man,
I never thought of that until someone mentioned it, like, 2 years ago.
You must not be, like, an RPG guy.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, Malcolm, I never thought of that!
I used to do that, and I used to do the lists, especially for Zelda. Good gosh. Because, you know, I always 100% my Zelda games, and I would, like, where did I get this heart piece? And I write it down, or where did I see this? And I write it down, because it's like, I don't like beating, well, you know, like, games with, like, guides and stuff. Like, if I get a Zelda guide, it's clearly for, like, nostalgia and, like, you know, like, to have the memorabilia. I will never use it to beat the game. I will not open that book if I have it. I my gamer probably won't allow me to do it, and I'll be stuck. And this is the guy that found 900 Koroks. Now, granted, I did use the mask for the first time, but after that, every time I did the 900 after that, I used an app. I don't care. Use the app, y'all. It's there for a reason. There's two Korok seeds.
Use the app.
I'm using the app too, but, like, when I was, like, ever since I was little, I would always, like, write this stuff down, and Zelda 2 really spurred that, because I had to, like, record a lot of stuff because it was so much to remember, and, you know,
there's a lot of spells. And they do different things to different enemies, and you gotta be like, okay, so the fire spell works on this guy, got it. Okay, so
not
the
even that,
spell
you gotta get that stupid
does this.
Yes. You gotta get that, you have to have the perfect number of magic containers to get the witch called spell, so you can even progress. And it was like, trying to figure that out, I was like, why? What is happening? Like, you know, like, what the heck? It was so much in that game that you had to be, you know, on point with. But, like,
it's,
I said,
adventure.
I like that challenge. Yeah, it's an adventure. And
no,
when you beat
it,
man.
Easy adventure. No one said it was the Sunday stroll through the park of Link.
It definitely
this
wasn't
is
that.
The true Link farming simulator.
Not even that. When you sit in that field and farm enemies just to get stronger, you know you were dialed in. You know you were dialed in. Like,
man,
hours
I
just
remember.
Farming.
You go through that whole thing. You die, lost all your lives. Just the
oh my
moment.
God,
like,
I hated
crap.
That.
Crap! Now I have that. To go through all of this and clear through oh, all man. Of this.
So
the dungeons
was,
have already been stoned out, so you can't go back to
can't
them.
Can't go back. Yeah.
See, this oh is that's gosh. Your that's your first mistake. You always leave the dungeon without putting the crystal in the pedestal.
Yeah,
the
I learned that later. I learned
because
that later.
Yeah. It'll give you a free level up no matter how many XP points it is. So you might as well save yeah. them for when XP is like really, really expensive.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because when I was playing this game for I was capturing some screen caps for this. I was playing the Famicom Disk System version.
Ooh, nice. Which,
yeah, I got it a little while back, and I'd never played the game through on the FDS before, so I decided to do it for this. And there are some interesting differences between the two versions, and the one that's relevant to the discussion right now is that in the North American release, when you get a game over, you don't like lose your levels at all. Your levels are fine.
I remember hearing about this.
Yeah, I heard about
but
that.
But
yeah.
on the disk system version, all your levels reset back to whatever the lowest one is. So if you wanted
yeah.
to pump all of your levels into attack or life or magic right away, you could do it because the game will not get in your way. But if you get a game over, it's going all the way back to one. And there were
That's
a couple
crazy.
Of times in this playthrough where I got a game over and I lost like yeah, like two levels is the most that you can lose. And yeah,
okay.
it is rough. Well, two levels of like different things, because I would yeah. usually keep them, you know, 4-5-4 or like 5-4-5, and then be like, okay, let's get that 4 up to 5, but then I wouldn't, and then everything would go back to 4.
That's funny.
But it's another.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, that was just another thing that kept me locked in the dungeons, because when I was on my last life, I would go, okay, I cannot screw this up because I
yeah.
will lose.
You dial in, yeah.
So much progress if yeah. I do that. So I just have to go for it. And there are extra lives that are hidden around if you know where to
yeah,
find
those,
them.
Yeah, those definitely help. Yes.
They do help.
They
but
like,
they're
what,
pretty well
two?
Hidden too.
Two or three?
They're pretty well,
there's,
yeah.
Yeah, there's only a few, and they are pretty well hidden. And
they do make the difference, though.
If you get a game
especially
over,
if you're not using rewind,
they don't come back, so you can only get them once.
Yeah. Only one time. Yeah.
Yeah.
So frustrating.
Yeah. The crazy part was too, like, also how much it made you dial in. But I was trying. Where was I going with this? The thing that I liked about it also was like, there were so many times that like you'd go to an area and you'd do well against the enemies, you know, selections they sent against you. And then you get to that one area where it's like you have to avoid getting knocked in a pit.
Yeah. Or avoid getting
once you fall in a pit, it's just game over. And it's like you're just styling out all these enemies. You're killing yeah. the knights and everything the best way
that
you
wasn't
can.
Those aren't even fair.
Those aren't even
not fair.
Yeah.
Fair. Ever.
I cannot tell you how many times I would be so ready to rage as a child, especially when I would get so far and I get to that one area with the lava pit and I get knocked in twice, gone, because I already lost my, you know, extra yep. man for whatever. And it's like, oh, well, back to the beginning. And I'm like, well, yeah, yep. I'm not playing this for a while. Let me go play something else.
But that's like,
this game
it's
is not for the faint of heart.
It's important in a challenging game to give yourself space to breathe and to take breaks so that you're not just bashing your head against the wall the whole
yes,
time.
Yes, that and is very important.
Zelda 2 kind of has like a Zelda 2 kind of has like a baked in excuse to take a break. When you
yeah.
get a game over and you go back to the beginning, huh, like I have to go all the way back over there.
Yeah, Ganon laughing.
Yeah, Ganon laughing.
That laugh is burned into my brain for eternity.
Forever.
Oh,
yeah.
As it will be with anyone who's played through
as
Zelda 2,
as is the epilepsy
sure.
that it induces.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
but see, you know what I love about that game is because it's all the stuff you go through, and when you finally make it to Shadow Link, he's, you know, him and what you call like the easiest fights, and it's like, okay, I'm not mad. You know, I went through hell to get here. If this is just how it's going to be, I don't care. Like, you
well,
know, so
do you,
I like
you,
that how they did
do
it
you
with
do
the game.
Crouch
oh,
in
no,
the corner?
I totally cheese it.
You do the crouch in the corner staff?
I've done the regular way a couple times, yes, and I can do it.
Okay.
But I will sit in that corner. I don't care. Depending on how my run has gone during that time, I'll sit in the corner.
I don't care. You understand, this game will drive you insane if it wants to, even if you're good at it.
This game demands that you take advantage of whatever
loophole,
whatever hole in the character's defenses that is possibly available to you. I am taking advantage. I am sitting there with the reflect and letting the thing just bounce into the wizards. I am sitting in that corner and stabbing Shadow Link to oblivion. I don't care. That Thunder Dragon was hell.
Yeah.
Stupid and this fur needs to go away.
Amazing. Amazing.
It's funny because like I said, I can do both. I can do the regular fight, I can do whatever. Sure. But you know, like Connor said, depending on how your runs go, like you'll take the easy win. But you're kind of approaching it
from like an I paid my dues kind of
way. Yeah, like, hey, listen, man. Listen, not even that. Think about like Indiana Jones. You know, he goes through whole you know, stuff, and then the guy's up here with the little attacks, and he just pulls out the gun and shoots him. Like, I'm not doing this. Yeah. I'm not doing this. Like, that's how I think about it. But on the flip side, I'm also the same guy who goes to the Water Temple and fights Shadow Link there in Ocarina, and I will make him hard just so I can have a good fight against him.
No,
you know how you
here.
Can train
Absolutely.
Him in the first couple of minutes. So it's like, you know, you get those games that, like, you know, are too easy, and then you want to make a challenge, and then you get games like Zelda 2 where it's like, okay, you know what? If I'm just going to sit in this corner, you're going to die to it. I don't care.
Yeah,
like it was hell to get here. I'll take it.
The final bits of Zelda 2 are fascinating because
they really are.
When you going up to the Great Palace, like actually reaching the Great Palace,
I love that music too. That's
hell
in and of itself.
Yeah, that whole
so many
I remember the first time, those are some of the pits I was talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. That whole grind up
going to the Great Palace, I finally get there. I have like no health left. No lives left. Because look, everything. You finally die because, not only is this an iron knuckle, this is an iron knuckle with ups.
With ups, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Not even and then it's to, like, no, I have to. You put me at the start of the palace. Oh my gosh, thank you.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like you've earned this at this point. This is like the final stretch. It's not interested in making you suffer. It just wants to make
you
engage.
Yes, it is. What are you talking about?
No, it's not interested in making you suffer. It just wants to make sure that you're not being lazy and that you're paying attention and not like getting hit unnecessarily, taking unnecessary damage and things like that. Not being careless with your play. That's one of the things in the article. Yeah. I talk about that with Death Mountain. In regards to, you know, that being an early difficulty spike to kind of be a microcosm of how careless play is just not going to get you through this game.
Yeah,
and you're not going to be able to brute force through it. You have to actually meet the game on its levels in order to get through it. And the Great Palace is no exception. And the lead up to that is no exception. Great
even
Palace
the Faka,
is awesome. I love it.
Yeah, even the Fakas, like,
oh, absolutely.
The way they move and how they challenge you, like, it's like you really have to pay attention. You can't just breeze through. And if you're used to breezing through with even, like, some of the other enemies, like Iron Knuckle and stuff, you're not going to do it with them. I've had times where I had to, like, dial in to beat one, or I just, if I can, I run and dodge. And I'm like, I'm not fighting until I get to the next room. Like, you know, so,
and that's all
I love about that enemy.
The fact that you're still scared of the enemies at the very last part of the game is like, that's so great. So many games, you reach the end of the game and you're like, I'm basically overpowered and nothing's going to stand in my way, essentially. But Zelda 2 doesn't let you get overpowered because of its low level cap. So
you could be stronger, but you're like, you're like just on the level, even if you are like maxed out. There's only a few
extra hearts and extra magic pots that you can get, and the rest of it is just, you know, level 8 on all of the stats, and you just gotta do it. You just gotta either do it or run away. But the fact
it turns
that
out you have to get good.
Well, it's not that you have to get good. I would never
you
tell
you do
anybody,
have to get good. I mean, this is the amazing thing about how this game is set up and how it set the precedent for the Zelda franchise as a whole from this point forward. The original Zelda gave us the general layout that they would eventually come back to of exploration, dungeons, puzzle solving, and all those things. The Adventure of Link gave us puzzle solving in its combat. gave us this system where combat and fighting and powerful enemies were not just a feature, it was the norm. This is where the world suddenly felt like it was out to get you. There is a sense of accomplishment and combat that for the most part you really only see in boss battles. But this, it's everywhere.
They can do it in just random rooms. There are some rooms in this game with regular enemies that are way harder than some of the bosses.
Exactly.
Yes, and I think I know a couple of those rooms you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's also what I love about like Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom. They both found a way to capture that, what Connor just said, in their games. Like, you know, even situations where like you're getting in there and it's like six bokoblins and like, you know, a moblin and like, you know, you have to figure out the best way to approach it. It's like, it really reminds me of like Zelda 1 and Zelda 2. And that's what I love about those games too, because it just brought that back to me. Like, oh, like, there's a sense of danger here. Like, I can't just run up here and let me sword swing. I mean, eventually you can get to that point, but like in the beginning, like when you first play the game, like, nah, buddy, you're not doing that like that. That was the first time in my life I had lost in a Zelda game in like years. I was like, did I just see a game over screen? What is this?
Yeah, it was so nice dying for the first time in Breath of the Wild. Amazing.
Oh, man, it was refreshing.
It was. Refreshing. It was really good. But yeah, Zelda 2 is really cool in that that kind of engagement where, you know, the fights are all puzzles and they give you this sense of accomplishment. Those are all kind of pieces to like the greater combat dynamic, because you have to back off and assess things in Breath of the Wild, and you have to back off and assess things in Zelda 2 as well. You can't just like walk up to an iron knuckle and just be like, eh, I think I'm done with you now. Whereas in most of the other games, like Wind Waker is a great example of how the Dark Nuts are basically, you hit a quick time event and then you just slap them a bunch and then they die.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah, but that's really fun to do.
Yeah, but like in Zelda 1, the Dark Nuts were really scary because you could only hit them from the back or the sides, which is still most directions.
And their movement pattern.
And they never always chose that exact moment to turn and stab you
to
back.
To turn, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Every time.
And the Iron Knuckles in Zelda 2 are similar because they're just an impenetrable wall. You can't just jump over them. You got to get through them. And they will make that difficult on you if you don't know what you're doing. Yeah.
The other thing I
love what you're doing.
Exactly. The other thing I loved about Zelda 2 is like those moments where, like, you know, say you got a new spell, like the fire spell or something. It's like, okay, this will probably make me stronger. Let me go ahead and use it on this enemy that's annoying as hell. And then you throw the fireball. No, you cast the spell, waste all that magic.
Yeah.
Throw the fireball and it does nothing.
Yeah.
And you're just sitting there like, oh, because magic is not a unlimited resource in that game.
And
so,
there's another difference from the North American to the Famicom Disk System version. The fire spell is actually optional in the Disk System version. Because like the tech types and things like that you can only kill with the fire spell in North American version, you can just hit them with your sword.
That's crazy. You serious?
Dang it! Why can't we have that?
I actually have a screen cap that I took that I didn't end up using in the article of me doing an upward stab on a Tektite that was jumping above me, which is just not an engagement that's possible in the North American version.
Yeah,
but
no, you can't.
My God, that's the perfect time to use the up stab.
It's in the article.
Oh, sweet. I thought I didn't.
You do have it in the article here.
Nice.
And I'm like, wait, what are you doing?
Yeah, there it is.
This seems like a horrible idea.
No, like that works in the Famicom Disk System version. Like,
crazy.
That can single-handedly like vindicate the up stab for anyone who's like, it's not as useful. No, it is useful, but just not in the version.
I mean, I've definitely
played.
Had my uses for it. So yeah, I've learned how to use the whole toolkit in general.
It's useful, but it's far more
wild
situational.
That you can, I didn't know.
Isn't that crazy?
That's wild.
Yeah. And so then
I wonder
I think because
you ever wonder why they. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I think it's because these areas are they'd be too easy to farm otherwise. Because like, Tektites are worth a lot of XP, and there's a couple of screens where you can like get them to pretty reliably spawn in. And so if you're just like going through and just, you know, one-shotting Tektites for a bunch of XP, that can kind of automate the process of leveling up. I don't think that that's the intent. I think the intent is to do it more gradually.
I wonder why they decided to make the American version harder. You think it's just something that at that time we were like, or do you think it's along the lines of what Connor said about how, like, you know, making the game harder brought more people to it? And, you know,
yeah,
because I mean, I'm curious, so, like, why would they change that?
It tends to be the case that the newer version, well, it tends to be more refined. As to whether usually it gets easier with the second more refined version because they've had more time.
It is easier in some ways because you can't level down, right? So that in that way, I'd say it's actually far easier than the disc system version. But there are a couple of things like that, like, you know, leveling up is a little bit more limited to streamline the process in the North American version. That's just to give players a leg up in the early game so that they're not, okay, well, I leveled up, well, what should I throw it in? Then it just says, you can just throw it in this and be comfortable with that. Or you can back out and save it for later. And
that's the real end game, knowing when to level up and what to level up.
That's the thing.
That's when you really get good. Yeah.
Another interesting change that I just remembered is that there's actually a lot of new music in the North American version. Some of the better themes in the game are actually just not in the original at all.
I think I've heard that much. Okay. I didn't realize there were that many differences.
There's
one thing
a lot
I also love about, I love that, like, it was the first time, like, we got, like, names for towns or
That's
towns
true.
In general.
Yeah. And then they used them for that, the sages later on.
Yeah. I love that. That little bit of lore building in the early days really. And, you know, establishing Link with the Triforce mark on his hand. And, you know,
like, I didn't just go into the town. I went into Ruto Town.
They didn't have towns at all in the first one. So
it's true. It's true. Yeah. It was a pretty barren landscape as far as.
I still love the first two Zeldas. Like, I know they were my first two, but they still hold a special place in my heart even to this day. And I think that's why I love how the Wild series really did with it, because it to me it was like a touchback, you know, to that time. You know, I always joke, I say Breath of the Wild is, you know, NES or Switch version of NES Link, Zelda 1, and Tears of the Kingdom is Zelda 2.
Link's Adventure. You're not the only one to make those comparisons, so don't worry about that. Well, for all of our viewers out there who have not taken the opportunity, if you have a Switch, you can play both Zelda 1 and Zelda 2 for free on the NES Virtual Console. So take a look, take advantage of the save and the rewind systems, and
I was actually
going
to tell you to not
good.
Use them. Don't use the save and rewind features at all if you want to appreciate
at least for the first time
properly.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, eventually get there, but I don't want to scare them away.
I don't know. This is something.
It's hard enough as it is. We just had this conversation.
We did, but also the difficulty is the point, and like locking in and realizing that you have to meet the challenge on its level is what makes it compelling. And if you skip over that part of the experience, then it's just going to cheapen your perception of the game as a whole, and you're probably not going to like it very much. But if you play it in the way that it was intended, you'll probably be like, oh, I get it. It's not that you have to get good, you just have to get a comprehension. You have to understand it.
And there's still
if
a save.
If you don't have comprehension,
yeah.
If you don't have comprehension, are you really good?
I refuse to tell people to get good.
You know
it's
what?
It's funny too that you say that because that newest Silk song came out and there's a meme already, and it's like, oh, can you change this? And then it's just Hornet sitting there like, get good. And it's like, well, can you make this easier? And she's like, get good.
You
and they're like, yeah, could
good.
You just...
You
and
just
he's to, like, get good.
You don't have to get good. You just have to... If you're struggling with the
you
game
you just
gotta
challenge
much,
yourself. That's all. Yeah.
If you're struggling with the game that much, then you're just approaching it from the wrong angle, and you have to rethink things. That's the long and short of it.
Yeah.
It's not get good. You just have to try something different.
Learn grow, adapt, improve, command, conquer. I don't know what the
command.
Anywho, everyone, thank you so much for joining us. Alex, thank you for your article and for joining me here for the podcast.
Thanks, thanks for having me. This was a great pleasure.
And Jason, thanks for jumping on in and joining us for our Zelda 2 discussion. Grateful that you were able to make it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, guys.
And to all of you who have been here for our podcast, we hope you've enjoyed your time here with the Zelda Universe podcast. My name is Connor Schultz. We try and do this every single month, so keep an eye out wherever you're getting your podcasts, over on YouTube, over on our Zelda Universe website. If you have not joined us over there, we are the largest online gathering of Legend of Zelda enjoyers across the world. We have articles, forums, and plenty of ways for you to interact, learn, and enjoy this great series that we love. We hope that you will join us next month. Have yourselves a wonderful rest of your day.